Santa Rita Hills, which are the Santa Rosa Hills. So if you think about the 40,000 acres that are encompassed in the Santa Rita Hills American Viticultural Area boundary, you can think about it like a 10-mile-long W between the north-facing slopes of the Santa Rosas, both the south and the north-facing slopes of the Santa Ritas, and the south-facing slopes of the Parisma Hills. So there's four different exposures that run as two coastal throats, east-west, basically between Lompoc and Buellton, but more precisely only within those areas that we consider sort of perfectly appropriate for the production of Pinot Noir. Literally, as we walked from hillside to hillside, sometimes even trespassing on people's land, we decided, looking at USGS 8.5 series map, does this area deserve to be in a world-class Pinot Noir appellation? So we really did choose the areas within these two valleys that we thought were perfect for Pinot, and that was back in 1996-1997 with Brian Babcock and Rick Longoria and a number of different other people getting involved in the petition process. But to understand the Santa Rita Hills, you got to back up and realize that you're looking, we're standing on a Miocene era seabed, and between 12 and 20 million years ago, the Pacific Plate and the North American tectonic plate crashed into each other right under our feet. And not only did it buckle and create these mountain ranges, but it also knocked this entire peninsula that's now known as Point Conception off the North American tectonic plate. So we're not on the North American tectonic plate, we're not on the Pacific Plate, we're on an autochthonous peninsula that is basically a free-floating cookie of land that is just above the North American tectonic plate, being pushed clockwise and north by the movement, the continued movement of the Pacific tectonic plate. The take-home message and why it even matters to Pinot Noir is that this entire peninsula is turning clockwise and moving up the coast of California, which means two things. One, in the last 10 million years, it's gone from the mountain ranges have all gone from a north-south orientation to an east-west orientation, and this east-west coastal throws are incredibly rare because you need something freaky like knocking this area off the tectonic plate and twisting it up due to shifts in the tectonic plates. So we have that absolutely unique east-west orientation of our valley, which goes straight to the Pacific. So the hotter it gets in San Ynez, hotter it gets at Lake Kachuma, the more cold air it's pulling off the Pacific Ocean. There's no north-south mountain ranges that are stopping that coastal influence. So even though we're 17 miles from the ocean right here, we have a coastal influence like we were 5 miles from the ocean. Nothing to stop the fog to move in at night and the cooling winds in the afternoon. And that's why when you leave Lompoc and head towards Lake Kachuma on a summer day, you can expect the temperature to go up 1 degree per mile as you travel east. 65 in Lompoc, 75 in Buellton, 85 in San Ynez, 95 out of Lake Kachuma. So that's why this little 30-mile corridor between Lompoc and Lake Kachuma is the most diverse wine-growing region in the world. 60 different wine grapes in a 30-mile corridor and 300 different clones all planted within this San Ynez corridor from Lompoc to Lake Kachuma. Of course, because we're a seabed, our soils are very poor. A lot of sand, a lot of loam, not a lot of topsoil. 2 to 3 feet down, we have a restrictive clay layer. So there's a loamy, sandy soil with almost no clay. No clay means no capacity for the vines to uptake nutrients. So our soil, even if it has a little nutrients, or even when we do fertilize, those nutrients, especially the nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, that are the macronutrients for grapevine growth, are very poorly absorbed by the grapevine. You need a positive charge of a clay molecule to make a connection between the root hair and the nutrient. So the less clay you have in the soil, the less the vine has the capacity for uptaking nutrients. Soil geeks call this the cation exchange capacity, or CEC. And our CEC is ridiculously, if not painfully, low, which means our vines are very inept at taking up nutrients, and they're having a very difficult time of it. So that's why the take-home message, poor CEC, poor sandy soils, which means small vines, low vigor, tiny clusters, tiny berries, very thick skins from the amount of calcium in the soil, which I'll go to in a sec. So as a result of the high calcium from the old diatomaceous earth deposits, because this is what we're looking at around us, is the largest saltwater diatomaceous earth deposit in the world. Because the diatomaceous earth, which with all the critters that died in this valley, when it rose out of the ocean and the water fled back into the Pacific, it left huge populations of diatoms. Diatomaceous earth was formed from the deposits, and that diatomaceous earth comes out of these hills alluvially calcium in an amazingly exchangeable state, which means the exchangeable calcium thickens the skins. The function of calcium in a Pinot Noir vineyard or any vineyard is the more the calcium that's exchangeable in the soil, the thicker the skins become. The thicker the skins become, the less juices in the grape. The less juices in the grape, the darker, richer, and more expressive the wine becomes. And I will say this is the moment where you describe the battle for the soul of Pinot Noir. Club Epi, thick skins, tiny amount of berries, 130, 140 gallons per ton, where you get 170 in Sauvignon Blanc or Cabernet. So there's already an amazingly built-in concentration and richness to the wines, even at the lower Bricks. But if you take these grapes to 30 Bricks and make a more sort of Parker/Laube-style Pinot Noir, you can make probably the most intense Pinot Noir in the New World from this property. But I look at it the other way. With that much built-in intensity and color, why don't we kind of ratchet the ripeness down, make Pinot Noirs in the mid-13% alcohols instead of 15.5, and allow the acidity and the natural mineral character to shine through these wines as they progress and become profound. So that, yep. Is this a 57? 57s won't pick it up. So that's it, really. Sandy, poor soil, which means the vines grow very small. These are 14-year-old grapevines. You'll notice that they're only an inch or two in diameter, where on the Napa floor, if you go to Beckstoffer and ask to see a 14-year-old vine, it'll look like a sequoia. Because, again, poor soils, sandy soils, no clay, minimal vigor, which, of course, means low crop yield, 6 to 7 clusters per pound, as opposed to seeing cluster weights in Grenache in the east side of the valley, 1.5 to 2 pounds per cluster. So the clusters are tiny, the berries are tiny, the amount of juice in the berries are tiny, and that's really what makes not only San Rey de Hills, but Club Epi kind of special because of the high calcium in the way that we farm. We don't give them a lot of chemical fertilizer. We do most of our fertilization with cover crop and the sheep manure and with organic nutrients in the soil to build the soil microbiology, because the more soil microbiology becomes more diverse and stronger, that gives the vine that advantage to be able to uptake nutrients to make sure we can at least ripen a crop of fruit at about 2 to 2.5 tons per acre, which is about the level that we're printing for.
In this corridor of the Center of the Hills, which is the northerly corridor, is irrigation a mandatory thing? Could you dry farm in this? Could dry farm in this?
The Sweeney Canyon, I believe, is the only vineyard that's dry farmed in the Santa Rita Hills, and we know of just how extraordinarily rich and concentrated those wines can be in a good year. I've just done some research on water and grapevines. The original Vitis vinifera sylvestris that emerged between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea about 20,000 years ago, after the last ice age 12,000 years ago or so, required in the forests of Azerbaijan and Armenia, where the grapevine emerged, we're talking 50 inches of annual rainfall. So the grapevine that was taken out of the forest and then turned into Vitis vinifera through some genetic mutations by human intervention, those grapevines were built around an idea of 40 to 50 inches a year. My general feeling is you need 20 to 30 inches throughout the year to be to have a bona fide and economically viable dry farmed vineyard. So, you know, at the average rainfall of 12 inches, between 10 and 14 here, it's very, very, very difficult to have any soil moisture naturally after May. So I would, you know, 99% of the planted acreage in the Santa Rita Hills is dependent on drip irrigation from groundwater. And of course, rainwater that we can see in the vineyard around us is very green, very lush, and extraordinarily wet after, you know, 6 or 7 inches of rain over the last week or two. That really focuses the vine's attention. Rainwater takes the salt out of the soil profile, takes the salt away from the vine's roots, while irrigation water actually builds salt at root level. So if we don't get this kind of a flushing through the soil profile at least every 3 to 4 years, we start seeing a reduction in crop level of about a quarter to a half a ton per year after the second to third year of drought. This, I think, is the fourth year of drought since 05, I think, was our last good rain year. So we've had 4 or 5 years at least with no real rainfall. And so this rainfall is going to be absolutely vital to giving us a good crop. We had a big crop in 09. If we still had all the salts, it would be very difficult, I would expect, to see a ton and a half out of this vineyard in 2010. But now with all this rainfall and getting rid of the salts, I think we can expect to see yields up in the 2 to 3 ton per acre range. Yep. drill the cover crop into the soil. We use rye, barley, annual grasses. We use three or four different kinds of clover, a couple kinds of vetch, a couple kinds of wildflowers for attracting beneficial insects. And then what we'll do is allow that to grow as high as it possibly can, because during the dormancy season, there's no problem with letting the cover crop get as high and as woolly as we want. We'll run the sheep through, especially down at the bottom of the vineyard where we're doing our sheep trials this year. We'll try to keep the cover crop down in that area as a result of sheep. This stuff will be probably mowed once, and then when at bud break, when we can get the tractor back in the field after the rains, we'll probably, we'll go ahead and disc and cultivate every other row. And then once the vines are 5 to 6 inches and we got to start getting the tractor and the guys in, we'll actually cultivate all the rows. So during the frost season, we'll have